from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, where would you say is the wettest spot on Earth? I don't mean where you've been sitting. I mean, you know, geographically. The wettest spot on Earth. Your travel agent will not tell you this. At least mine didn't. So I found out the old-fashioned way. Took a 20th anniversary trip there. You want to get? No. What is this, NPR? Kauai, ladies and gentlemen. Kauai. The wettest spot on Earth. And what's the coldest month of the year in the wettest spot on Earth? That's right, it's March. Okay, your travel agent wouldn't tell you that either. You don't need to thank me. But you will. So, what happens in Kauai? The wettest spot on Earth, the coldest month of the year? Well, if you're very, very lucky, just as you're leaving, the nice TSA guy asks you, is your checked bag locked? And you say, no. And when you get home, you discover that apparently he didn't trust you, tried running the combinations on the lock, and locked your bag. And you've never had a combination because you've never locked your bag. And so your significant other spends a day at the airport in this end, at this end, trying to get the bag opened. And you're welcome again. Hey, everybody's welcome. And to the lovely TSA guy at the Kauai airport, I say aloha and mahalo. I say it in the New York sense of the word, as in go aloha and mahalo yourself, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, follow the dollar. Two stories to share with you, and one distinct difference. So for the first story comes from Politico, and it's about why you can't use your electronic gadget on the plane. Airlines haven't been eager to jump through the hoops and red tape or pony up the money for the testing that would let their customers use their devices, because the FAA says as long as the airline can show the FAA that the devices are safe to use on its planes, you can use them. Questions remain about how to let passengers use their favorite devices while protecting safety. The basic concern is that a signal, well, you know why. Although, interestingly enough, I've had the opportunity once or twice in my life to fly on a private plane. You can use your electronic devices during takeoff, during landing, no problem. But they got special electronic things. No, I don't think so. Regulators and researchers also insist that while one errant signal, such as from a pilot's iPad, yes, the pilots are allowed to use iPads now, probably wouldn't be enough to down a plane. 150 different devices bombarding the plane's equipment is another matter entirely. Says one Senate aide, 300 iPads, we're not sure what that means, on a mix of devices for an additive effect, that could be a problem. So the additive effect, ladies and gentlemen, is one of the major reasons why you are inconvenienced. But that's just you. Now, on the other hand, another additive effect from Science Daily, throughout our lives, we're exposed to an enormous range of man-made chemicals. At the request of the European Union, researchers in Sweden have looked at the risk of chemical cocktails and have proposed a number of measures that need to be implemented. In 2005, an American study showed that newborn babies have an average of 200 man-made chemicals in their blood, including pesticides, dioxins, industrial chemicals, and flame retardants. And so your baby won't catch fire now. Don't get upset. In a Swedish study, the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences found 57 different pesticides in Swedish rivers and streams, many of them occurring simultaneously. But the effects of chemicals on humans and the environment are evaluated for regulatory purposes, on the basis of single substances, chemical by chemical. The additive effect does not prevent multiplicity of chemicals from being let loose, because it would inconvenience people who contribute a lot more money to political campaigns than you do. Follow the dollar. Hello, welcome to the show.
problem is all inside your head, she said to me. The answer is easy if you take it logically. I'd like to help you in your struggle to be free. There must be 50 ways to leave your lover. She said it's really not my habit to intrude. Furthermore, I hope my meaning won't be lost or misconstrued. But I'll repeat myself at the risk of being crude. There must be 50 ways to leave your lover. 50 ways to leave your lover. You just slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. Just get yourself free. Or hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just drop off the key, Lee, and get yourself free. Ooh, slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. You just listen to me. Hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just drop off the key, Lee, and get yourself free. She said, it grieves me so to see you in such pain. I wish there was something I could do to make you smile again. I said, I appreciate that. And would you please explain about the 50 ways? She said, why don't we both just sleep on it tonight? And I believe in the morning you begin to see the light. And then she kissed me, and I realized she probably was right. There must be 50 ways to leave your lover. 50 ways to leave your lover. You just slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. Just get yourself free. Or you hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just drop off the key, Lee. Just listen to me. Hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just drop off the key, Lee, and get yourself free.
Played to commemorate the passing of a major league record producer called Phil, won multiple Grammys for working with a lot of big-name artists, and never had an actress in his house with his gun in her mouth. From the edge of America to the world, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcome you to this edition of the show. And now, yes, the movement continues. You can't stop a movement. Can only interrupt it. News of the Olympic movement, I say. Produced by Jim Ebersole Jr. Arkady Rotenberg, the boyhood friend and former judo partner of Russian President Vladimir Putin, is already collecting his winnings from 2014's Winter Olympics. Rotenberg's companies have been awarded at least 227 billion rubles, $7.5 billion worth of contracts, for the Sochi Winter Games. That's more than the entire budget for the last winter, no, sorry, for the 2010 Vancouver Winter Olympics. Yeah, that is the last Winter Olympics. Though it represents just 16% of Russia's latest estimate for the event, which promises to be the most expensive ever. The contracts, which number at least 21, include a share of transport link between Sochi and ski resorts in the Caucasus, a $2.1 billion highway along the Black Sea, a $387 million media center, and a $133 million stretch of tarmac that will link various venues and double as Russia's first Formula One track. This is a monumental waste of public money, says somebody who doesn't want to live very long in Russia, Stefan Zimansky, a sports economist at the University of Michigan. A small number of people at the top have control of resources and there's no accountability, he says. Russia is the most corrupt of the group of 20 economies, according to Berlin-based Transparency International. Rotenberg told the Financial Times last year that while he values Putin's friendship, he'd never abuse it for personal gain. It beats beating Putin's enemy, I'll tell you that, based on recent developments. Count me as a friend. Some small companies who worked on the London Olympics have been left bitter and cynical because they're still unable to discuss their involvement for fear of breaching sponsorship rights, Parliament was told this week. Companies are traveling to Rio to bid for work on the Games in 2016, but they feel they still could not promote their involvement in London 2012. Matthew Griffiths, chief executive officer of a trade association for people who supply technologies and services to the event and entertainment industries, said businesses understood the importance of protecting sponsors when they signed up, but he said what no one thought would happen was that post-Olympics, that ban would stay in place, or there wouldn't be a relaxing of that ban. Post-Olympics, it would seem only fair and right that companies that took part would be able to say that they took part. It's ridiculous, he says. The company that built the iconic Olympic rings that went up, they're not allowed to talk about it. Many of the companies now feel bitter and cynical about it, he said, adding, they've given up on it, really. And from down Rio way, a stadium in Brazil that was due to host athletics at the, that's track and field to us, at the next Olympics, has been closed indefinitely because of structural problems with its roof. The João Avalanche Stadium in Rio was built way back 6 years ago. An embarrassment for Brazil that it prepares for the Olympics. Authorities have acknowledged delays in work on another stadium and a funding problem at still a third, which is set to host the opening match of the World Cup. The Olympics, it's a movement. And we all need one. Every day. Well, thank goodness that's over. Ladies and gentlemen, the leaks of the week. The Department of Transportation has fined ExxonMobil $1.7 million over pipeline safety violations relating to an oil spill in the Yellowstone River. What could be wrong with that? Exxon's Silvertip pipeline, which carries about 40,000 barrels per day of crude in Montana, it does get crude in Montana, leaked about 1,500 barrels of oil into the river a couple years ago after heavy flooding in the area. Exxon has previously said the accident cost the company about $135 million. Please give. The risk of flooding on Yellowstone River was a known threat that could cause the pipe in the river to lose physical support and potentially rupture, said the U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration this week. It said the spill would have been about two-thirds smaller had company workers responded quickly. But Exxon is Polish for slowly, isn't it? Royal Dutch Shell shut a 170,000-barrel-a-day pipeline this week that moves Gulf of Mexico crude oil to Houma, Louisiana. That's Houma, Louisiana. After the pipe leaked in Terrebonne Bay, Shell shut the 16-inch pipeline at about 5 p.m. March 23 after a light oil sheen. You remember him? He used to be on 2.5... No, was observed near a pump station, according to a spokesperson for Shell. Shell plans to inspect and repair the pipeline as soon as possible. And authorities are working to clean up an oil spill in central Arkansas after a pipeline ruptured. Police chief of Mayflower, Arkansas, says an ExxonMobil pipeline sprang a leak Friday afternoon in his small city about 20 miles northwest of Little Rock. You know where that is. He says the pipeline has since been shut off. The spill forced authorities to evacuate dozens of homes. Oil spilled onto the road and lawns. It's unclear exactly how much. ExxonMobil says it's investigating and working with local authorities in cleanup efforts. The breach, it says, was a pipeline that originates in Illinois and carries crude oil to the Texas Gulf Coast. the leaks of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Just so you know, because it's not all anything. And now,
ladies and gentlemen, we are proud to present Let Us Try, a ballad of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Let us try to stem the tide, to beautify our countryside. We offer you our hand. Let us try.
Well, Soledad O'Brien, in her farewell to CNN this week, was proud of her role in reporting big stories. She noted the standing ovation she got at New Orleans Airport for CNN's work on Hurricane Katrina, as she called it. Here's the latest part of that story, which I don't think you'll see on CNN. This is from the New Orleans nonprofit news site, The Lens. Full disclosure, I help support them. By Bob Marshall, a great environmental writer, formerly with the Sometimes-Picayune. He asks, what do you call a navigation gate in a hurricane protection wall that was plugged into the system because it could be built faster and cheaper than a more proven design that was installed after research showed it could not perform as originally planned, that might not be able to close unless another distant gate is closed first, and that now, after almost a year of trial, still has not been operated successfully. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers calls it the barge gate on the Gulf Intracoastal Waterway and, quote, a system they have confidence in. But Bob Turner, regional director of the South Louisiana Flood Protection Authority, has another name for it. Just 2 months before hurricane season begins, insomnia. It's the thing that keeps me up at night the most, says Turner, an engineer, whose sense of worry is heightened by the knowledge that many lives and livelihoods depend on this gate working properly. It's an incredibly complicated design that will take 9 hours to close effectively, and that the Corps still can't operate successfully after repeated attempts, he says. I keep seeing us trying to close that hole in the wall with a storm coming and having nothing but problems, unquote. The barge gate gets its name from its main element, a mammoth concrete barge, 190 feet long, 70 feet wide, 44 feet deep. You paid for it. It is not so much a gate as an emergency dam to be used on a temporary basis during storms. The design calls for the huge barge to be swung into a 190-foot gap in that beautiful wall you probably have seen. The Corps spent years showing animated versions of artist renderings of that wall, and you probably saw it last June when it was dedicated and when the Corps bragged about it. Once in place, the barge is filled with water and sunk to prevent storm surge from pouring through the main defense of the city. Even as a temporary fix during Hurricane Isaac, members of the flood authority spent anxious days worrying that it might fail. Corps officials say there's nothing to worry about. All gates have bugs, and they're working them out. Turner and fellow members of the Flood Protection Authority don't share that confidence. Barge gate has become a four-letter word as the Corps prepares to hand over the keys and responsibility for operation and maintenance of its $14 billion system by June 1st. Complaints are numerous. The Corps backed off the operational parameters originally promised for the barge gate. Closing it takes too long and is too complicated. And by the way, it has never been closed without breaking. You know, gates do that. They break. Other than that, Turner said with a rueful laugh, we love it. The story of the barge gate goes back when CNN was covering this story, admitting that its own catastrophic engineering failures caused more than 50 ruptures in its levees and flood walls, killing more than 1,500 people and drowning 80% of the city, the Corps promised to do better. The answer was the hurricane storm and damage risk reduction system, $14 billion worth, which was supposed to have been finished ahead of the hurricane season 2 years ago. A key was preventing the confluence of the Mississippi River Gulf outlet, which the Corps built in the 60s, and the Intracoastal Waterway from funneling storm surge into the heart of the city, right by the lower Ninth Ward, where it did flood in 2005. The answer was this massive surge barrier, a 26-foot, 1.8-mile-long concrete wall stretching across the intersection of the two waterways, permanently shutting the mouth of those waterways was not feasible because there's a navigation thing going on there. The solution was a main gate that would be kept open unless storms were approaching, and a secondary gate that would remain closed except when the main gate needed to be shut down for maintenance. For the bypass gate, Shaw Group of Baton Rouge chose the rarely executed barge gate design. The Corps' senior project manager for the upgrade says he knows of only one other barge gate under construction or in use in the entire United States. He said the barge gate choice was based on budget and speed. Regular gates cost about $33 million, the barge gate $26 million. They saved $7 million, ladies and gentlemen, to have a thing that doesn't work. Shaw, the contractor, got to make the choice, but the Corps insists they wouldn't have had it any other way. The Flood Protection Authority didn't object at the time either, Turner said, because the original plans called for the barge gate to remain closed, except when repairs to the main gate would be required. That would be about once every 10 to 15 years. So it was not a problem then, because it wouldn't be open during storm season. It became a problem when the Corps announced a change of plans 3 years ago. The barge gate would have to remain open all the time, and then would be closed only for hurricanes or other emergencies. That was based on two new pieces of research. The speed of the tidal currents caused safety concerns, and the Corps' environmental section finished research showing the opening was not large enough to show adequate passage of fish larvae. So all this came up in the design phase. Corps spokesman said he did not know why the environmental concerns were not raised earlier. So both problems could be solved, the Corps decided, by leaving the nearly 200-foot-wide barge gate open full-time. No alternatives were considered because, quote, we were too far down the design path to actually change. This is the same process, ladies and gentlemen, that led to the defect in the system that failed catastrophically in 2005. The gate has to be closed 96 hours, four full days, before a storm in the Gulf is expected to begin affecting conditions within the waterway, the Corps says. Well, we always have 4 days' notice when a hurricane gets severe, don't you know? Let us try, ladies and gentlemen, the motto, and it is only a motto, of the United States Army Corps of Engineers.
We boarded the boat on the breast of the river so wide, and we left old St. Louis on the crest of that brown muddy tide. To the strains of the Delta Queen's band I found myself holding your hand way we had hoped we would do all that summer and fall. Oh, the whistle came out, such a deep, mellow sound in the night. And the echo came back from a shoreline of twinkling lights. There was nothing we really could say. The river had swept us away. Like a present hereafter, the warm sound of laughter as we danced to the Delta Queen waltz. I find myself holding you near. With the nighttime unfolding, I'm lucky just having you here. As a single wave curls down the shore, we're waltzing away across the floor. As our heartbeats assemble, the boat slightly trembles as we dance to the Delta Queen waltz.
You're listening to the show, or just letting it play unheeded in the background, whichever. Ladies and gentlemen, the new F-bomb, foreclosure. A national survey found 301,000, almost 302,000, zombie properties dotting the U.S. landscape. No wonder The Walking Dead is so popular. In which homeowners, you see, in foreclosure have moved out, leaving vacant properties susceptible to vandalism and degradation. We had the story from Reuters earlier this year on the problem of zombie properties. Is the first time we know how many, or at least some idea of how many there are. Florida tops the list of zombie properties. Some might say it figures. With 90,000, more than 90,000 vacant homes in foreclosure, according to Realty Track, Illinois and California rank second and third, respectively. The number of homes overall in foreclosure are bank-owned rose by 9% to 1.5 million properties nationally in the first quarter of this year, compared to a year ago. Almost 11 million homeowners nationwide remain at risk because they owe more than their property is worth. Yeah, looking good. Realty Track analyzed data on zombie properties after that Reuters special report in January. Reuters revealed the plight of people who walked away from their homes not realizing their names remained on the deed and they were still financially liable for taxes and other bills related to the abandoned property because the banks refused to take possession. They didn't want the maintenance and the tax responsibilities. In some cases, homeowners vacated after receiving a notice from the bank of a planned foreclosure sale, only to find out later the bank never followed through. And on the subject of the new F-bomb,
he's not a general.
He commands no troops.
He's not an inspector.
He peeks at no stoops.
He's an Inspector General.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, yeah.
The Inspector General weigh in on the new F-bomb. For your listening pleasure, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, the FHFA, is neglecting to ensure that banks selling federally backed mortgages follow consumer protection laws. That's according to the agency's Inspector General in its second report in a week, blasting the agency for being AWOL when it comes to overseeing home mortgage lenders. You might ask at this point, why do we need the federal government backing mortgages? The best I can find out, ladies and gentlemen, is from people who supposedly know about this, that if the federal government didn't back home mortgages, about 90% of them at the current rate. Nobody would lend money for people to buy homes. Aww. Government-sponsored mortgage giants Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae are supposed to make sure their loan sellers and servicers are complying with prohibitions against unfair, deceptive, or abusive practices. That's according to the Dodd-Frank Act. The banks are also bound by federal anti-discrimination, equal credit opportunity, and borrower privacy laws. Does Freddie Mac enforce those rules? Well, in a way, it relies on the sellers and mortgage servicers' self-certification that they're following the laws, according to the IG. Wouldn't you like it if you could self-certify? No, you'll go blind if you do. Freddie Mac has no formal monitoring program, the report says. Fannie Mae has no written procedures for monitoring the banks. Certify yourselves, banks. Fannie and Freddie's contracts warn the loan sellers and servicers that they must comply with state and federal consumer laws, but neither institution backs up its words with guidelines, monitoring, or enforcement, according to the IG. Of course not.
They're banks.
And following that raft of abuse in the home mortgage industry, including improper foreclosures, Freddie Mac and its federal regulator agreed 2 years ago to require loan servicers, those are the people who, well, those are the companies who collect the monthly payments after you've gotten the mortgage. And the bank has sold the mortgage to somebody else. The loan servicers to report borrowers' most serious complaints and resolve them within 30 days. It's Freddie Mac and its regulator agreed to do that. Yet 1 year later, neither Freddie Mac nor the Federal Housing Finance Agency, FHFA, was enforcing the rules, according to the Inspector General. That's the other report this week. That's because they were put in place without any penalties for failure to comply. Nice system. And because no one was paying attention. Banks largely failed to report the complaints, the Inspector General found, and some even said they didn't know about the reporting rules. Neither Freddie Mac, the nation's largest dispenser of government-backed home loans, nor the FHFA noticed. The numbers point to a near-total lack of compliance with the rules between October 2011 and November 2012, the period evaluated by the IG. Looking at data provided by four of Freddie Mac's largest servicers, the IG found they'd handled 20,999 serious consumer complaints during this period. Not even Herman Cain was informed, yet they did not report a single one to the FHFA. In fact, a staggering 98% of participating banks didn't report any serious complaints over the 13-month period, nowhere near the 20,999. They can't say it wasn't an easy number to remember. News of the Inspector General, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. So it's a holiday week. President did some traveling just before. And right before he left the country, and supposedly after he comes back, there will be a continuation of it. The president changed tack, not tact, tack, look it up, regarding his way of dealing with his Republican opposition. It was a big, big topic of discussion in Washington for about the first 3 weeks of the month. The president's so-called charm offensive, in which he invited Republican leaders to the White House for dinner. Now, it seems sort of commonplace and normal, except he hadn't done it during the entire first term. And so, after the latest in this endless series of budget wrangles, apparently the decision was made for him to have John McCain, Mitch McConnell, some of the House leaders, Eric Cantor, and John Boehner to dinner at the White House. And apparently that's not all he and Senator McCain were doing.
Well, John, I'm glad you could make time in your busy schedule to accept my invitation.
Mr. President, you know that whatever our differences, any time that the Commander-in-Chief calls me and it's not a Sunday morning when I have some network TV appearances scheduled, I'm at the Commander-in-Chief's disposal.
Well, I appreciate that, John. It's important to me, and it's important to the country.
Well, I just know that if I were the Commander-in-Chief, I'd certainly want my invitations accepted. We have our differences.
One being, of course, that I am the Commander-in-Chief.
Obviously.
Obviously.
But if preparing a meal with you can help the country heal some of this rancorous partisanship, heck, Mr. President, I'll swallow more than my pride.
Well, and, you know, not just preparing a meal, John.
Boy, I haven't done this since Cindy's hair moved.
I just think that if you will, these budget negotiations have the country skating on thin ice.
I mean, you got me out here just to live out a metaphor?
It's good exercise, too.
Uh-huh.
Especially if you stop holding onto the railing.
Well, to fight metaphor with metaphor, sir, I'm the kind of Republican who still holds on to the railing of common sense. I think that may be why you think we can do some business.
John, we both want what's best for the country.
Yes, sir.
But you've got some wild men and women on your side of the aisle. We just sent our wildest guy, Dennis Kucinich, to be a crash test dummy on Fox News.
Let me ask you a question, sir.
Uh-huh.
When you want to stop, you just hold on to the railing harder?
Yeah, I had the pool reinstalled, replaced the transparency center. They were using it.
You know, my shoulders never really recovered from the torture.
Well, but we're looking forward, John, not backward. That's one thing we can agree on, right? Right?
Of course, your daughters are younger than my Megan. Mm. It makes a big difference. You can still control them.
Well, for maybe a minute more.
Well, you know, in a way, that's a lot like my house brethren.
Oh. Yeah, except you don't have to pay their tuition to Sidwell Friends.
Yes, but you don't have to go to retreats with your daughters at White Sulphur Springs.
Oh. You seem tense there.
Yeah, it's where they hung you by the arms.
Oh, we don't look backward. We look forward.
So, look, we're really not that far apart.
Yeah.
You guys want to privatize Social Security? We want to gut it gently. There's got to be some meeting ground somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, there is. Ooh. My guys will be happy to make that deal, just as long as it doesn't look like they're doing business with you. That's poison in their primaries. Oof.
Want some more hot chocolate?
Sure. Tastes a little funny.
It's carob from Michelle's garden.
I'm fine.
So, look. You know, if I keep denouncing your guys and your guys keep denouncing me, it'll look like
we're still denouncing each other.
And that gives everybody cover to make the deal.
Well, I have to think about it. Talk to some of the guys and the gals.
But we can do this again, right?
You mean this little tete-a-tete?
Uh-huh. Maybe something a little less strenuous so that looking forward doesn't bother you so much.
Mr. President, whenever you call, as long as it's not on a Sunday morning, I'll be happy to come see you.
Oh, thanks.
I'm sure, had things been a little bit different, you would have done the same thing for me.
Of course I would. But we're looking forward.
Right.
And now, the apologies of the week.
So sorry.
There's some bold-faced names in the apologies this week. But first, facing a growing chorus of Republicans urging him to offer a more full apology for his use of a racial slur, Alaska Republican Representative Don Young has obliged. Pardon me. Quote, I apologize for the insensitive term I used during an interview in Ketchikan, Alaska, Young said. There was no malice in my heart or intent to offend. It was a poor choice of words. That word and the negative attitudes that come with it should be left in the 20th century, and I'm sorry this has shifted over our focus away from comprehensive immigration reform, unquote. In a radio interview Thursday, Young called Latino ranch workers on his father's farm wetbacks. Deadline New York, CBS analyst Doug Gottlieb got coverage of the NCAA Tournament Sweet 16 off to an awkward start, saying he was there to bring the white man's perspective to the network's pregame show. Speaking on a panel with four African-American men, Gottlieb made his comment Thursday during a pregame segment. I don't know why you guys asked me. I'm just here to bring diversity to this set. Give kind of the white man's perspective, he said during the show. Fellow analyst Greg Anthony made a face after the remark. Kenny Smith said he had jumped right into it. Gottlieb was still on the set Thursday night and unavailable for comment, but he issued a statement through CBS. It was not a smart thing to say, and I apologize. Charles Barkley said he made a joke earlier tonight and people are going crazy. All those idiots on Twitter, which I would never do. All you people at home who've got no life and are talking bad about Gottlieb, get a life. It's over with. It's no big deal, unquote. Now, boldface name for your listening pleasure, former CIA chief David Petraeus has apologized to those he hurt and let down in his first public speech since resigning over an extramarital affair. Petraeus said at USC his actions had caused pain for family and friends. So does speaking at USC. He said he hoped his fall would teach others that life doesn't stop with such a mistake and must go on. He quit after his affair with biographer Paula Broadwell was discovered during an FBI investigation. Petraeus said he was also, quote, keenly aware that the reason for my recent journey was my own doing. So please allow me to begin my remarks by reiterating how deeply I regret and apologize for the circumstances that led me to resign from the CIA, unquote. So what led to our journey into Iraq and Afghanistan, Dave? Oh, you! CBS, under fire from veterans for last week's episode of The Amazing Race that featured a segment in Vietnam filmed at the site of a crashed American B-52, opened last Sunday's show with an apology. Read by the program's host, Phil Keegan, apologizing to veterans, a note apologizing to veterans, especially those who served in Vietnam, for being insensitive. All of us here have the most profound respect for the men and women who fight for our country, he said. Ford India, the Indian unit of Ford Motor Company, has apologized for advertisements described as demeaning to women, including one depicting Italy's former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi with a trio of bound and gagged women in the trunk of a car. A Ford India spokeswoman, see, they have a spokeswoman, what's your problem? Said the company is investigating whether anyone at the automaker ever saw the print ads, which were never used commercially but appeared over the weekend on a website showcasing creative advertising. Similar ads featuring Paris Hilton, apparently kidnapping reality television rivals, the Kardashian sisters, all three sisters tied up and one in a bikini. Those appeared as well. Ford said it regrets the incident, calling the images contrary to the standards of professionalism and decency within Ford. The parent company of the advertising agency WPP Group said, we deeply regret the publishing of posters that were distasteful and contrary to the standards of professionalism and decency within WPP Group. I know those standards. They are amazing. Matt Lauer has apologized to a former NBC intern on Twitter for not being a nice guy. The embattled Today Show anchor has been the subject of many rumors and reports over the past few months. His situation became even more complicated when a former intern said on Twitter that Lauer wasn't very nice to him during his stay at the network. Although Lauer doesn't generally respond to folks who reference him on Twitter, he soon issued an apology to Mark Zinni if he did do something to offend him. The BBC has apologized unreservedly to the family of a reporter who is believed to have killed himself for the way complaints he made about harassment at the network were dealt with. The broadcaster admitted some aspects of the handling of complaints made by Russell Joslin were, quote, not good enough. The U.S. Embassy in Chile has apologized for a tweet indicating it was bored or irritated by former Chilean President Michelle Bachelet's bid to run in November presidential elections. An embassy bored, really? The Hollywood Reporter admitted to stealing code from Penske Media Corporation, parent company of rival publication Variety, as part of a recent settlement the two companies reached. And the reporter also apologized. A Yuma, Arizona school is considering hiring armed guards after an influential state senator barged into a classroom and verbally threatened a teacher over a dispute involving his teenage grandson. The name of the state legislature?
Republican State Senator Don Shooter. That's right. A shooter barged into the classroom. Senator Shooter. He called the school principal this week and apologized. Shooter could not be reached for comment. Shoot. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, this. News of the Godly, in a ceremony conducted by the Archbishop of Turin, the Shroud of Turin was shown on television over the weekend for only the second time in its history. The 14-foot-long, 3.5-foot-wide cloth is normally kept in a bulletproof, climate-controlled case in Turin's cathedral. It's rarely open to the public. The last time was in 2010 when more than 2 million people lined up to pray in front of it, and then Pope Benedict visited. The latest display coincided with Holy Saturday. A few hundred people, many in wheelchairs, were invited inside the cathedral for the service provided over by the Turin Archbishop. It was only the second time the Shroud has gone on display specifically for a TV audience. The first was in 1973. Apparently, it won't be the last.
This time, the fabric's the same.
It's the most famous fashion relic, the side of Coco Chanel's original little black dress.
But the designs are as different as you are.
I surrounded it in a cloud of magenta voile because that just adds to the mystery. Not that you need any more.
And the tension's even higher.
I think spangles, framing the face, or whatever it is, are just the right kind of kitsch.
Designers, out there in 15 minutes.
Oh, my God. The spangles still aren't here.
Project Shroudway. Can the world's most famous fabric make the world's next fashion icon?
Tune in and see.
Project Shroudway, coming soon to Lifetime 3, the newest way to watch your lifetime away.
the jealousy off your back. If you don't get the envy off your track, who's gonna run you down but you? A man got to make it right his own mighty cloud of joy. He got to make it right his own mighty cloud of joy. Hey, hey, he got to make it right his own mighty cloud of joy. He got to hustle up right his own mighty cloud of joy. Hey, hey, he got to make it right his own mighty cloud of joy. Every day he got to make it right his own mighty cloud of joy. Got to hustle up right his own mighty cloud of joy.
Ladies and gentlemen, this week, the latest in a couple of attempts by television networks to ease out marquee talent. Rumors surfaced that NBC was trying to slide Matt Lauer out of the Today Show. They asked perhaps Anderson Cooper to take over. And rumors surfaced that from ABC that Barbara Walters was quitting, even though she's maintained she's staying at The View, just leaving the news division. Barbara Walters, of course, no stranger to controversy. A couple of years ago, another news person sang a humorous ditty at a dinner alleging that Barbara Walters had had 82 facelifts, and Barbara Walters went on The View the next Monday, the following Monday, to firmly deny it. And, well, there's not tape of that, but there's something close.
"82 facelifts may seem like a lot. Talk about wailing in the years. Tightening a tittle or smoothing a jot. Facing down all of my fears. It hasn't been easy, and it hasn't been fun going through what I've gone through. But one thing I'm proud of, like a dad of his son, it's been 54, not 82. How could you have 82 facelifts? What could be left to lift? The scalpel can't be your constant companion. Surgery is a gift. If I had had 82 facelifts, my nose would be on the floor. My brow wouldn't furrow, my lips wouldn't bend. I'd look as bizarre as Liz Taylor's best friend. I take 2 hours to cut and a half year to mend. So I won't have 82 facelifts. I'm happy with 54. Who could perform 82 facelifts, seeing the same new face? You can remove that many wrinkles without something to put in their place. If I had had 82 facelifts, I'd have to go back for more. It would be as addictive as tobacco or crack. My skin would have been pulled halfway down my back. I'd be subsidizing an obvious quack.
So I won't have 82 facelifts. I'm happy with 54. I'm happy with 54.
That's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast through KCRW.com, iTunes, and Sideshow Network. And to be just like... never saying wet back again, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. The tip of the show, chapeau, to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, in exile in Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. More than 83,000 people follow this broadcast on Twitter, at The Harry Shearer. I don't know why. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist of the music heard here on, available at harryshearer.com. There's also a fabulous store there. You buy everything there, but for the Shroud of Turin. And, you know, I don't want to speak too soon about that. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW, Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.